Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Foreign Press Association's briefing with Ambassador John Bolton, who is speaking about anything that we want him to speak about, really, about the many subjects that are in the world. We are in the position of over-fulfilling the alleged Confucian curse about may you live in interesting times. These times are beyond interesting. They're positively bewildering. So on every level, whoever would have thought a few years ago that a Republican Congress people would be blocking aid to Ukraine in support of basically a Russian dictator. But such it is. And I'm sure that John and me and others were all lost sleep last night, waiting up late to see who won the Russian election, which has just been announced. You wonder why they bother. I mean, at least Stalin used to count the votes and declare them himself. Putin has to get other people to do them for him, such is the state of Soviet, the current 5-year plan. So I'm talking to John Bolton, who's prepared to answer any question. But I think that's the key one. I mean, can you see what the end game is? All the reports from the front suggest that the Ukrainians have actually taken, to some extent, big setbacks directly because of the Republican contingent in the Congress stopping aid going to them at a crucial time in the war. Do you see a way out of this? What is the way out?
Well, I think there are several elements that are contributing to the gridlock in Congress, and especially among members of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. It may be hard for outside observers to grasp how this works together in American politics. That would be understandable. It's hard for many of us to understand how it is now working. But the aid to Ukraine has gotten caught up in a fight about our policy on the Mexican border, about how to contain illegal immigration and threats to national security, which the Republicans overwhelmingly, just as a separate issue on the issue of border security, think the Biden administration has done a bad job. But somehow it's gotten mixed in with not just aid to Ukraine, but aid to Taiwan, aid to Israel, both of which are quite popular, under the theory that some in the House say Biden cares more about Ukraine's border with Russia than he cares about America's border with Mexico, which is a total non sequitur. I mean, I believe Biden's border policy is a failure, but that shouldn't prevent us from doing what we need to do to render assistance to Ukraine. Nonetheless, because it's now gotten the attention of Donald Trump, that's had a significant impact on the confusion in the House, because he didn't want the border problem resolved, because he thought it would be better for his own political prospects to leave it unresolved. Now, none of this really has much to do with a geopolitical analysis of whether rebuffing Russia's aggression against Ukraine remains in American interest. In fact, I think even among Republicans in the House, which is more affected by Trump than the Senate is, I'd still say 75% of the Republicans would say, yes, it's important to aid Ukraine. They would quarrel about the Biden administration's strategy in Ukraine, which is a fair criticism. He doesn't know what he's doing, and he really hasn't since the beginning. It's against basic Republican principles to throw money at a problem, whether it's foreign or domestic, without knowing what the end game is. But nonetheless, if this bill gets to the floor in the House, and I think it will receive overwhelming approval. The problem is now a procedural and political problem. In addition to not being able to get a resolution of the question of aid to Ukraine, we've still got a good two-thirds of the federal government not funded for the rest of this fiscal year. That should be resolved this week, he said, knock on wood, we'll see. And then I think after that, the problem of aid to Ukraine can be addressed. Another part of this problem is Republicans have a very thin majority in the House. With resignations and retirements, it's really down to two or three votes, which means that a handful of obstinate people can stop almost everything. So these are not good explanations, but these are some of the reasons why it's been held up. And I do worry that the delay that we've seen incurred in the chaos in the House of Representatives has had a negative impact on Ukraine. I don't think this is fatal, but it's certainly not helpful. The new Speaker of the House said over the weekend that he did have a timetable to get the Ukraine aid to the floor. And as I say, if you could get through the procedural parliamentary complexities and just get a straight up or down vote on the House floor on the aid, it will pass.
But there are some people around Donald Trump, especially that minority you're talking about, who are holding everything to ransom. They often give the impression that they're more interested in seeing, in inculcating chaos into the proceedings than they are in achieving any identifiable political gain or endpoint.
Yeah, look, there is swirling around Donald Trump a kind of nihilism that turns on his view that really the only thing important in the world is Donald Trump and all the rest of it's kind of incidental. So we've got in Congress, in both parties, I should say, a group of people who are not really legislators, they're performance artists. And their goal in life is to do well on social media. And some of them are having a fantastic run at it at the expense of Ukraine, which is unfortunate and unwise. The issue of this, what I call the virus of isolationism, is something that's going to have a reckoning within the Republican Party at some point. If Trump loses, we will surely have it beginning the day after the election. But even if he wins, we're going to have it because as president, his ability to affect foreign policy is obviously the dominant factor in national security decision making, which is one good reason not to vote for him for president. But there's no doubt these people are not thinking in any kind of geostrategic sense. I mean, I guess that's the good news. The bad news is they're just not thinking about what they're doing. And in a closely divided Congress like we have now, it's very easy to say no. It's much harder to get the yes.
Well, our distinguished member, David Andelman, he's speaking on Friday before the EU forum in Luxembourg, and he wants to know whether you feel that the EU and NATO are preparing sufficiently for the Donald Trump contingency if he became president. And do you have any suggestions on the direction such preparations should take place, apart from a preemptive European invasion of Washington?
Well, you know, I think it's important for our friends in Europe, whatever their opinions are, to understand that when they voice their opinions and they're heard in America, they're quite likely to have the effect opposite of what is intended. So telling us how bad Donald Trump is may reflect your view. It may, in fact, be exactly the same as mine. But it's one thing for me to say it, and it's another thing for a foreigner to say it. So one way of planning for Donald Trump is not to do it out in public where you decry the potential consequences. As I say, not that I would disagree with him. I'm just talking tactically here about how not to diminish the effect of the Western alliance. It's not clear, for example, with Trump, when he might decide to withdraw from NATO. I think it's nearly certain that he will, but it may be he has advisors around him who can find ways to delay. This is not an issue you want to force to decision. I like to say with Trump, it's never final until it's final, and maybe not even then. So the longer this issue remains undecided, the better off we all are. I think the effect of an American withdrawal from NATO would be so catastrophic that there isn't any effective way to plan for it. It would mean the end of the alliance. There may be another alliance that replaces it, But it will not be NATO, that's for sure.
It's an interesting, you raised the point that foreign leaders' criticisms of US leaders can be counterproductive. There's a particular case where Bibi Netanyahu has been very trenchant in his criticisms of Joe Biden and previous presidents. And I'm wondering why you think that that sort of arrogance does not backsplash when Americans are going to say, excuse me, if our president offers him advice, then he better take it if he wants to keep taking our money.
Well, I don't think Netanyahu has been so critical of Biden. I mean, I think he's gone out of his way to try and maintain the bipartisan support in the United States that Israel has traditionally had. I actually thought you were going to mention Senate Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's comment the other day.
I was coming on to that.
Israel should have a new election. But I would just say, and that's a pretty direct rebuke of Netanyahu. I mean, he equated him with Hamas as being one of the factors obstructing peace in the Middle East, which is pretty dramatic when you think about it. But I will predict, and I'm happy to hear what others have to say on it, but I will predict that Schumer's statement about Israel having another election and Biden's support for it has done more to strengthen Bibi Netanyahu's position than almost anything else you can imagine. So I understand the concern in Europe about a U.S. withdrawal. There's plenty of concern about it here, too. But the question is, how do we avoid it, not how do we accelerate it?
And, well, of course, what we're trying to avoid, is a Trump re-election. What can be done about that? It looks increasingly, I mean, a lot of people are looking at the two candidates and saying, yeah, there must be somebody else somewhere.
Polls have shown 70% of the American voters do not want a rematch of 2020. And that's exactly what they're going to get. Just in case people are bursting at the seams wanting to know what I'm going to do, I'm going to do the same thing I did in 2020, which I think many others will do the same. I live in Maryland, where you can write in the names of people who are not major party candidates. You can not on the ballot. I wrote in the name of a conservative Republican in 2020 because there wasn't a conservative name on the ballot. And I'll do the same this year. There are a number of third party independent candidates. They will not come anywhere close to winning the election, but they may draw enough votes, particularly in swing states, where it could affect the outcome in those states and thus the allocation of those states' electoral votes. I mean, it's a very unhappy election for me and for others who don't think either one of these candidates is competent to be president.
Well, the campaign in Michigan to write in uncommitted, to vote uncommitted, seems to have actually produced results in the case of the twitch in Biden's policies.
He's very nervous about the anti-Israel left wing of the Democratic Party deserting him. But he better watch out, because there's still a pro-Israel wing of the Democratic Party, which might desert him if he's not careful. This is why the best answer to your question, what do you do to stop Trump, is for the Democrats to nominate somebody other than Joe Biden. Former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said a year or more ago, in an optimistic way, any Republican not named Trump can beat Biden because he's so unpopular, he's so vulnerable. Now, I think analysts would say Biden is so unpopular that even Donald Trump can beat him. And in fact, there's an argument that Biden may be the only Democrat who could have a chance at their nomination, maybe the only Democrat who could lose to Trump. If the Democrats nominated somebody, you know, shockingly young in their late 40s or early 50s, I think it would have a dramatic impact on the race. And remember 1960, when John Kennedy ran against the Eisenhower wasn't running, but Kennedy cast his candidacy as one of youth and vigor, as he said, against Eisenhower, and it was very successful.
Indeed. Well, not for him personally, as it turned out, but that's
Well, I'm talking about 1960, but the Democrats have great lack of confidence in their younger generation, and that's why they keep ending up with Biden by default. But I think it's a very risky and politically probably erroneous strategy for them.
It almost reminds me of when I was in India and the purpose of elections was to determine who the oldest was and then elect them. A sort of gerontocracy.
Yeah, well, we're doing that this year, that's for sure.
So Martin Burkhardt, U.S. correspondent for Information, I don't know the Danish pronunciation, a national daily in Denmark. He'd like you to look at the issue of whether you should compare pre-war isolationism with what's happening now. Are the two not different in nature, he asks? The 1930s are not the 2020s. And secondly, did skepticism amongst GOP voters of foreign aid and even not seeing Putin in as sinister a light as the Democrats start long before Trump? Remember Bush saying that Putin had a soul.
Right. Well, that was not one of his best lines, I must say. Republican skepticism of foreign aid, and I speak as an alumnus of the U.S. Agency for International Development, has largely been skeptical of economic foreign aid and particularly multilateral economic foreign aid. Military assistance has not been particularly objectionable. But what is reflected on the Ukraine question is, I think it is related to the 1930 decade kind of isolationism, because it reflects the view that what happens out there in the wider world doesn't affect us, and that we don't need to care about what happens if there's war in Eastern Europe. It's just not, in that view, something that affects us that directly. And I think that's exactly what people in the U.S. thought in the 20s and the 30s, that we had saved Europe in World War I and let's have done with them and get back to normalcy, as they called it in the Harding administration. Now, I think that's a very simplistic view of the world. It was simplistic in the 20s and 30s, and it's even more simplistic today. But that's what they think. The idea that it's because they don't see Putin as a particularly threatening actor is really confined to a very few people who don't know anything about Putin or history or a lot of other things. It's more a generalized feeling that people in Washington, the establishment, the deep state, if you want to call it that, care more about foreign affairs than they care about Americans. And that strain has always existed within the Republican Party, but it's been very, very limited in recent years until Trump unlocked it again. And that's what the fundamental problem is we're facing today. If Trump disappeared tomorrow and a responsible Republican got the nomination for this November, I think we'd be right back to Reaganite approach to foreign policy.
Well, as Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local, but I've always got the impression that Americans, there is a presidential exemption that Americans see their president, they want to see how their president looks on the world stage. He represents the country. So, you know, if it's becoming apparent that people are contemptuous of the United States because its president is a bumbling bozo who appoints his relatives to all high positions, then that is surely going to splash back on the electorate eventually.
Well, I think there will be a backlash after Trump. As I say, I have always seen him as an aberration, not as a real tendency. And it's not like he has a coherent isolationist philosophy. He doesn't have any coherent philosophy at all. And he's reacting to a question of how does he look most influential? How does he look most central? So he can say completely nonsensical but unrefutable things like, if I were president, Putin never would have invaded. If I were president, Hamas wouldn't attack Israel. If I were president, we would have a tariff deal with China. All of these things are highly unlikely, but there's no way to prove them wrong. It's part of Trump showing that he is the unique figure who can solve these issues.
Well, the other issue that's come up from Robert Papa is nepotism, which has always been a problem in politics, but people forget that the nepotism comes from the Pope's quote nephews unquote being appointed to high positions around the Vatican, and we have the equivalent now with nieces and daughters-in-law and others being appointed to high positions in the RNC and other jobs up for sale around the world, Middle East peace negotiators, depending on your relatives. Is this going to sort of come unstuck for Trump in the short term? Can you run an administration by appointing related incompetents?
Well, I think it was a mistake in the first term for Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump to serve in the White House. I think they damaged themselves. I don't think they will serve if there's a second Trump term. I think putting his daughter-in-law at the Republican National Committee really is an embarrassment. It has nothing to do with the people involved, but it shows how few people out there Trump really trusts. And that is what is more dangerous about that. Rather than these people getting the positions, is the loyalty test that Trump will impose in a second term on his advisors, cabinet officials, and others, which is, will you be personally loyal to me as opposed to the Constitution? Obviously, the president makes the final decisions. This is not a question about advisors making the decisions instead of him. The president will always decide. But no president, including Donald Trump, is served by a bunch of yes men or yes women who simply execute the first thing that comes out of his mouth. Every other president has figured that out, but not yet Trump. And that's another real danger of what kind of administration he will have in a second term. The one ray of hope in there is that Trump will be a lame duck the minute he takes office, because the Constitution prohibits a third term, even in his situation where he'd have two non-consecutive terms. It's two terms, period. So if he's elected, he will be in his last term the day he's inaugurated.
But he can do an awful lot of damage in 4 years.
That's true, and it will be a struggle, and I'm very worried about it. I've said before, and I do believe he caused damage in his first term, but it was largely repairable, and in fact, it is being repaired. Damage to the country, damage to the Republican Party. In a second term, some of the damage he could do would be irreparable, and it will be a long, difficult 4 years. But politics moves on, and just to give one example, senators elected this November will have 6-year terms, meaning their terms expire after Trump leaves the White House. So this class of senators will already have 1 foot in a post-Trump world.
We have interesting buildup of questions. One of them, just to jump, because since you mentioned that many of the Republican know-nothings who are holding stuff up in the on Ukraine, how are they? You mentioned their proclivity for social media. So, what are your views on TikTok? Is it a real issue, or is it something that's been, a quick electoral thing? Chinese involved, so it must be bad.
No, I think it's a real thing, and I think the Bipartisan Committee on China in the House, which is one of the few functioning House committees, and one of the few where there's any real substantive bipartisanship, was united on this bill that passed the House, which I don't think goes far enough. I would simply ban TikTok in the United States. And there are two reasons for that. The first is it is a propaganda agent of the Chinese government. And it's no violation of the First Amendment for the United States to be able to say, we're not going to permit foreign governments, particularly totalitarian foreign governments, from trying to influence American public opinion. That's not guaranteed by the First Amendment. That would make the Constitution a suicide pact. as Justice Jackson once said, and if the Constitution is anything, it's not a suicide pact. Second, and actually even more dangerous, there are substantial reasons to believe, and I'll just stop there, but there are substantial reasons to believe that what TikTok is really doing is collecting data on the users, sending it back to China, where it is being aggregated into profiles, in effect, of TikTok's users. Now, you say, but, you know, there are 300 million people in America. That's true. I don't use TikTok, so that's one less they have. But the Chinese have spent decades hacking into information systems in the United States and removing data to get a better picture of both individuals and social dynamics in the United States. For example, it's now about almost 10 years ago, the Chinese, this is public information, the Chinese extracted all of the files of U.S. government employees in the Office of Personnel Management. Now, you may say, what could be more boring than federal government personnel records? And the answer is what it tells you about the workforce of the federal government. In my case, for example, I've had more FBI investigations of me and my family so I could get security clearances and the like than I can. I mean, I've lost track of how many they are. Now, I've led a sufficiently boring life that my FBI files, I think, probably make for pretty uninteresting reading. But there are a lot of other people who have had much more fascinating lives, all of whose data is now in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. So this, I don't know exactly what the Chinese project is, but this collection of information is something they've done throughout the days of the internet, and they used to do it before that. Xinhua, the so-called news agency in China, has been another agent of the Chinese state to vacuum up information around the world through its entire existence. So TikTok, to me, is just one example, although a very popular one in the United States and really around the world, that shows the covert Chinese efforts to gain information which could give them leverage against their adversaries.
But have we left ourselves open to this by, free trade in information? If how do you stop the Chinese doing this if you allow Elon Musk and other millionaires and you know, media moguls from doing the same thing? That we have grown up to assume, or the society has grown up to assume, that there's untrammeled free enterprise in the information systems, and that the regulations there used to be for the FCA, for example, about fair comment, don't apply because they're in they're limiting competition.
Well, you know, I'm a laissez-faire person in economics, and laissez-faire person in speech. You know, we don't censor the New York Times, as irritating as it can be sometimes, or any other print media. They're not foreign governments. Elon Musk is not a foreign government. What needs to be corrected is the loophole in the communications laws, section 230 of the Federal Communications Act, I think it is, that does not hold social media companies responsible for what's on their platforms. That's like saying that they get the benefit of printing or publishing on the internet whatever they want without any liability. The New York Times, Washington Post, have that risk of liability for libel or slander or a variety of other things. And I think it's important to correct this defect by repealing Section 230. That won't solve all the problems, but I think it could have a significant impact, including because it diminishes the protected status of these internet platforms, reducing their overall influence.
Well, in Britain, there's a sort of counterexample is that Russian oligarchs with checkbooks and bent briefs, as they call them in London, lawyers can sue people into silence simply by the threat of litigation that they don't have the resources to combat. So where is the balance here between sort of regulating and ensuring responsibility for what's published and silencing them.
Well, I believe in the free marketplace of ideas. Chinese Communist Party is not a free market player. And I think there's a real bright line distinction in prohibiting or limiting what foreign governments can do to us as opposed to limiting our own citizens.
Let's see. Stefano Vaccara, U.S. Political correspondent for Italia Press, wants to know, should Europe immediately start building an alternative to NATO?
Good luck. Look, this is part of the problem. I mean, it's Trump has played on NATO members. I was going to say European NATO members, but this applies to Canada, too, who have failed over a 10-year period to meet the commitments they all made at Cardiff, Wales, at the NATO summit then in 2014, to spend 2% of their GDP on defense expenditures. There were other commitments as well, but the 2% commitment is the one that's most important. Now, I and others, hundreds, probably thousands of American diplomats and military officials have argued for decades that the Europeans should spend more on defense. Constantly, and we failed to persuade them to do it. We were arguing to increase defense spending for a stronger NATO. Trump's arguing about the failure to meet the 2% commitment to undercut NATO. And he makes a point that many Americans are sympathetic with. Why should we pay? Why should we subsidize a German welfare state when they won't spend 2% on defense? When Trump made this point at the NATO summit in Brussels in 2018, one prime minister of a European government that I will mercifully not name.
Please name names.
Said, you know, look, we're trying to spend 2%, but our economy's growing so fast that we can't make it to 2%, which brought guffaws from the American delegation, because that's an argument was our economy is so robust we can't afford to defend it. You know, these are the kinds of things that Europe could solve, maybe too late now, but could solve by just agreeing, by just fulfilling the commitments that they made on spending. And why is the year 2014 significant? Because that was the year Russia first invaded Ukraine. And a lot of people in Europe, at least in the eastern parts of it, woke up and said, my God, war on the continent of Europe, not because of the disintegration of Yugoslavia, but because of an unprovoked attack by the Russians against Ukraine. And yet, even today, after 10 years, a lot of countries, including Germany, still haven't made it. Now, people will say, well, Germany's committed to doing it this year. Great, that's fantastic. How about 2025 and how about 2026? You know, it's it would be nice if people reach their commitments. But I will tell you, my view is that the level of threats worldwide are such that the United States is going to have to go from its current level of about 3.5% of GDP on defense back to Reagan era levels between 5% and 6%, which means, friends in Europe, you're probably going to have to come up to about 4%. The Secretary of Defense in the United Kingdom, Grant Shapps, just said a day or two ago, Britain had to go to 3%. And he's right. And that's it. They're going to have to go higher. And so is everybody else.
Well, they're going to have to do it better. They're going to have aircraft carriers with aircraft that fly.
So, well, that would be nice, too. Yeah. I mean, part of the problem in Germany is their ships don't sail, their planes don't fly, their tanks don't roll. So they're going to have to spend a lot just to get back to where they might have been otherwise.
Skipping, you know, tour d'horizon, I've always assumed that Moldova and Transnistria are the sort of cross between Schleswig-Holstein, as a question, and Sarajevo as a potential tinder. I did actually meet Alexander Lebed, the general who put the troops there to begin with, and he had nothing but contempt for them. But it was Russian, it was ours. So he moved the troops in. Is there any end point out of that, or is it going to be there like a fulminating blue fuse?
Well, this is one of the frozen conflicts left over from the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I think neither Europe nor the United States over the last 30 years has paid adequate attention to it. And now Transnistria is a real potential problem. I've visited Moldova, which very few senior American officials have ever done, but I went there shortly before I resigned, unfortunately, in August of 2019, because this issue of literally a Russian fifth column, small at the time, but in Transnistria behind Ukraine's front lines today, is a problem not just for Moldova, but potentially for Ukraine as well. And, you know, we let the Russians get away with this as we let them get away with seizing Abkhazia and South Ossetia in 2008 in Armenia, as we've allowed the frozen conflicts in Armenia and Azerbaijan to continue, as we've seen others in Central Asia. We did not adequately finish the breakup of the Soviet Union, and now it's coming back to haunt us.
That certainly wasn't a supervised divorce. It was a
Yeah, I mean, we had the opportunity, and maybe even the Europeans may have thought they had a better opportunity, but nobody carried through on it.
No, people just move on to next parish. David Andelman says that all the states that are actually frontline to Russia have met the 2%. And his implied question is whether you could differentiate and tell those that have met the 2% that yes, they're covered by the guarantees of NATO, and tell the others no, we're cutting you loose.
Well, this is actually a suggestion made by a Trump advisor fairly recently, and I described this in a Wall Street Journal op-ed I wrote. So how exactly does this two-tiered NATO concept play out on the battlefield? Suppose the Russians invade Poland and we spring to their defense, because they spend more than 2% on defense. But the Russians this time have their act together, as they have not in Ukraine, and they push us back, and we're being forced back toward the German border. And Germany hasn't paid 2%. So what's the American commander supposed to do? Call up his Russian counterpart and say, excuse me, we're about to hit the German border. You can do whatever the hell you want in Germany, but you have to let us leave, because we're not going to defend Germany. We need to get over to the Netherlands, or whatever country has the next border and country is paid for 2%. And we're sorry about having to leave the Poles here, but we can't be forced back into Germany. So we're leaving. I mean, you can't logistically, operationally, command and control, you can't have a two-tier NATO. If you're in the Baltics, this is a very serious problem. If you don't have connectivity with the rest of NATO, and, you know, if you cut out Germany and other countries that are not doing 2%, it's a serious problem.
I mean, it's not just a case of 2%, though, isn't it? There's a political will, and more NATO recently has begun to look like a pale Occidental imitation of ASEAN.
Well, look,
in terms of ineffectiveness.
Yeah, for all those who said in the past 2 years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Biden has really led a strong NATO, that's ridiculous. Look at the latest disagreement over whether German Taurus missiles will be supplied to Ukraine. Our strategy has been all but non-existent. We have not given Ukraine what it needs in a coherent fashion. And the Biden White House and Germany and other countries have pursued not a policy of victory for Ukraine, but a policy of non-victory for Russia, because we're all deterred by the Putin threat of a wider war, which I think is totally hollow. So I think NATO has done a poor job. It has at least prevented Ukraine from being overrun, but that's a pretty low bar.
While we're, it goes beyond that, though. I mean, how do you run an alliance like European Union or NATO with countries like Slovakia and Hungary, which seem to be operating completely in opposition? I mean, just about managed for many years to have Greece and Turkey, who hated each other far more than they hated the Russians, How can you manage a coherent military alliance on the front line with the vagaries of politics?
Well, it's very difficult. It was unconscionable, for example, what Hungary and Turkey did to the applications of Finland and Sweden. Now we finally got that taken care of, but that was irresponsible as well. I think in Hungary's case, there have long been allegations about bribery by the Russians of senior Hungarian officials, in other countries as well. I think the biggest problem for Hungary is its reliance on Russian oil and gas. Which, by the way, Ronald Reagan warned Margaret Thatcher, warned the Germans about late in his term, do not become dependent on Russian oil and gas. And much of Europe did so anyway. And that leaves a problem that we haven't found a solution to either. And I remember when Viktor Orban 30 years ago was a small L liberal politician in Hungary. I think he's betrayed the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 by his behavior.
Yes, well, he's betrayed the Hungarian people because he deprived their democracy, no matter which side he put it down afterwards. We have had dealings. Who else have we got here? Sandra Muller says Donald Trump and family are all over social media, while Joe Biden is more discreet. He launched his first video on Instagram last week. He's also more discreet during the last election and still won. Do you think that these strategies can have an influence on elections? Will
well, you know,
quiet discretion win the day?
Yeah, I think discretion is out in American politics. Trump is, that's another effect of Trumpism. Look, Biden's got a problem among young voters who don't have a history of high voter turnout, but are traditionally more supportive of the Democratic Party. And the polls show him very weak among that group. And that's a group that uses social media a lot. So I think politically, he probably doesn't have much choice but to do it. And he just needs people in his communications office who are in their 20s who speak that language. And I expect he will rely on it heavily this year. If he doesn't, I think that adds to his problems.
Well, getting back to high profiles or low profiles, you have in the past been somewhat unflattering about Nikki Haley, and there's much to be unflattering about. Do you see a future for her in the GOP, says T. Fagusso?
Well, I think she clearly thinks she has a future, and I think 2028 is wide open. We've had a recent development here that I think is significant. Mike Pence, just a few days ago, said he was not going to endorse Donald Trump for president. And I say good for Pence to say that. Inevitably, at this moment, attention is going to turn to Nikki Haley to say, okay, you suspended your campaign some weeks ago. Given what Vice President Pence has now done, will you also decline to endorse Donald Trump? And I'm going to be very interested to see what she does.
We have missed out one of your sort of favorite subjects, and mine, in fact, the question of Taiwan. One of the sets of aid being held up is the question to Taiwan. So we have this dichotomy that you have Republicans prepared to beat up China on a commercial front, but basically provide a ferry line across the South China Sea from the mainland to Taiwan. How do you think this is working out?
Well, I think, Taiwan has a new president, vice president coming in soon. I know both of them quite well. I think they're responsible people, and I think they will be good leaders for Taiwan, but they need American help and help from others as well. So this conflict over these aid packages, as you rightly say, it's not just Ukraine that's being held up. It's not even just Taiwan that's being held up. It's aid to Israel that's being held up, and it's funds to help close the Mexican border that are held up. So I hope people understand this is evidence of confusion and disarray, not coherent strategy. And therefore, if you remove the principal instrument of chaos, being Donald Trump, I think things would revert in fairly short order to the more traditional distribution of power. I think, for example, if you had a Republican president strongly supporting Ukraine against Russia, it would be a matter of minutes before the left wing of the Democratic Party came out in opposition to the war. You know, they're supporting it now only because Biden is president.
I beg to differ a little there. I think there are democratic principles in it. It took them a lot of hard searching to get as far as they do now, because in the past they'd have assumed that Moscow represented anti-imperialist world consensus.
They still do. Some of them do.
Well, some of them do. Some of them do. Yes, but I was somewhat gratified to see how few they were. I expected far more, to be honest. Simon Locke says over the weekend, Trump was calling for the jailing of Liz Cheney, which is straight out of the Putin playbook. Are you concerned that Trump will be dictator for more than a day, that once elected, he will sort of follow the norms of democratic behavior, or that he will rather consolidate his power and issue the emergency decree and dissolve the Congress?
Well, good luck with that. Fortunately, we have courts, but that are independent. I didn't catch the reference to Liz Cheney over the weekend. If your reporter knows where it was, the rally in Ohio or what, but no, I didn't see it. That's a real danger with Trump. He has said retribution will be one of the highest objectives in his second term. And I've written a new foreword to my book, which is out in paperback now, The Room Where It Happened, in case you don't remember the title. But in the foreword, I talk about what a second Trump term will look like. And I make the point that retribution against Liz Cheney, against Mark Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, against all of Trump's political opponents, is a very real risk. And while ultimately they may be vindicated in the courts, Trump is a prodigious litigant who puts other people to great cost and effort to defend themselves. If he's president, he'll have the government to act as his lawyer. So I view this as a very, very concerning prospect if he wins.
But he has been packing the courts at levels all the way through. Or let us say that his choices dominate many of the federal courts and the local courts.
Yeah, fortunately, I will make this prediction. 99% of his nominees will do the right thing. There will be an occasional judge who doesn't do the right thing because of what you've mentioned, one of whom may be Eileen Cannon, who has the classified documents case in Florida. Her record on this case is not very great. But I'm really not worried about the vast majority of his nominees who have already ruled against him in any number of cases back in the 2020 election recount and have been ruling against him in some of the recent cases as well.
I see he's just failed to meet his bond requirement in the New York case.
Yeah, this is a very interesting development. He's basically said nobody in the world will put up a bond for him in that amount. And obviously he wants relief from it. I don't know what the New York courts will do, but the whole point of the bond requirement on appeal is so that the winner is not prejudiced by the loser basically getting out of town or selling his assets and concealing them. So there's a real principle of justice at issue here that, as usual, Donald Trump will try and twist because, after all, he's being picked on.
Yes, well, 400 million is quite a lot to take down to the marshal's office and put in an escrow account.
Yeah, it's up really to 500 million if you consider interest and things like that already, and growing every day.
What's a few tens of millions between friends? The name came up early days, but will the Kennedy third party candidate skew results the way the Nader candidacy did for Gore? I mean, I must say that the Kennedy candidacy seems to be almost as much part of the three-ring circus as Trump.
Well, I don't know the answer to the question. It's possible Kennedy is polling well. Obviously, he's got a famous last name. It looks in the polling so far at a very slight level. He hurts Biden more than Trump. But it is a fact that as you get closer to election day, third party and independent candidate shares of the vote have tended to slide. We'll see what happens this year. It really is uncharted territory. But remember, in a close election, even the diversion of a few thousand votes in key states can make a big difference. People would argue that Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate in 2016 in Wisconsin and a few other states, was the margin of difference between a Hillary Clinton win and a Donald Trump win. So she's running again. Cornel West, a left-wing African-American academic from Harvard, is running. RFK is running. There may be a candidate by the group No Labels. We don't know that yet. Very hard, I would say, impossible at this point to predict what impact they will have.
Especially with the underwhelming personal support for Joe Biden amongst many of that constituency.
Right. This is another reason why the Biden nomination is not an act of wisdom by the Democratic Party from their own point of view.
I agree. Not my point to agree here. Now, one of the difficulties with the geopolitical situation being so fractured is that with the major circus in town going on, there are things smoldering in the underbrush. So we've got China and the Mohammed Arif Yaqubi says, it seems that China is in a close relationship with the Taliban. Does that mean more relations for the US? And there's high tension between the Taliban and Pakistan. How could this make the region more complicated?
Well, I think this was perfectly predictable when the Biden administration withdrew from Afghanistan in the summer of 2021. The Trump deal with the Taliban was a mistake. I don't think Taliban ever had any intention of complying with the commitments they made. And I think the withdrawal of the U.S. and NATO opened a strategic vacuum in the middle of Asia that the Chinese, the Russians, and foreign terrorist fighters are happy to fill. It leads to continuing tension with Pakistan, which already has its own problems, as we can see by the imprisonment of Imran Khan, which I think opens enormous potential for China, even more than it has now in Pakistan. So we've turned our eyes away from Afghanistan and the region after the withdrawal, which is always a mistake. We watched this happen in the 1990s when Taliban came in the first time. Now they're back again. The American and NATO presence in Afghanistan was really a very small commitment. There's no war going on as we understand that. The government was struggling, to be sure, but it was making progress. Taliban has rolled all that back for women and children, girl children, no prospect of changing it. So I think the growing Chinese influence, perhaps looking for minerals as well as geostrategic positioning, was baked in when we withdrew.
While we're in that region, I know it's one of your particular concerns has been Iran and the attention, what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Yemen, what's happening in other places, mean that the noise about Iran has died down, that the so-called Abrahamic partners are cozying up, let's say, being a lot less hostile to Iran as they work out which side the cards are stacked up on. So do you think there's a potential for, on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula, for trouble to come?
Well, I think the Gulf Arab states are hedging because they think the United States policy under Biden is feckless. And there's a lot of merit to that view. I think Iran is really behind the conflict in Gaza, behind the Houthis' effort to close the Red Sea to international commercial traffic, behind Hezbollah's threats to northern Israel, behind the Shia militia attacks on American military and civilian installations in Syria and Iraq. This is not an Arab war against Israel we see in Gaza. It's an Iranian war against Israel using its terrorist proxies. And I think Iran is probably very surprised at the extent to which Israel has decimated Hamas's fighters in Gaza. There's still more to do, but I don't think the war is going entirely according to Iran's plan. And that's why I think its pursuit of nuclear weapons and its other support for terrorism around Europe, around the United States, also are receiving inadequate attention.
Well, it doesn't exactly seem to be going to Netanyahu's plan either. I mean, we have a bunch of cat-chewing nomads on the end of the Gulf there, holding the world's commerce to ransom on the Red Sea. So it seems a very successful. And by the way, I happen to think the Houthis are quite motivated on their own without that they're glad of Iranian support, but I'm not quite sure they need Iranian motivation.
Well, that none of them need motivation, but they need drones and cruise missiles and other weapons that Iran is all too happy to supply. I think this is the what the Iranian Quds Force itself calls the ring of fire strategy around Israel. I don't think it's working out so well in this episode, but I'm sure that there's more to it.
Okay, well, we're almost coming towards our time up. I've got to thank you very much. It's always a pleasure even to disagree with you, because at least we're disagreeing with people who know what they're disagreeing about. when we have next week, it's on your patch as well. Tinatin Japaradze from the East West Institute is coming to talk to us, you know, about the, she stopped biting her nails about the Russian election and wants to talk about the aftermath. We've had Tinatin on before. Tinatin is a Georgian, educated in Moscow, London, and the US, and is now with the East West Institute, and wrote a book about Stalin, which is brings us two different periods of isolation. So looking forward to that. That's next Friday at 12 o'clock. Do come and book in. And once again, really grateful to Ambassador Bolton for coming in and sharing his forthright views with us, which let's needless to say, the foreign press do not necessarily endorse everything that Ambassador Bolton has said. But we're always interested and intrigued because that's what the press should be about. But thank you very much, John, and hope to see
My
you
pleasure.
Again soon.
Good luck to all of you. Thanks a lot.